fiction, suspense, and the moral imperative.
If you don't have moral purpose, you can't write a novel. You have to have some intense feeling about right and wrong in order to write 350 pages of manuscript and do it right.
That's Alan First. We spend the hour with him today talking about his latest novel, Spies of the Balkans. And then we air an encore interview about his 2006 book, The Foreign Correspondent. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Master of suspense Alan First sets his novels in Europe just prior to and during World War II. Most of them take place in the Balkans, with sorties to his favorite city in the world, Paris. His books deal with a fight between freedom and fascism and the decision between saving yourself or risking your life for the common good. I first discovered his work while I was living in Amsterdam in 1999. First was much better known then in Europe than in the U.S., but his reputation has grown in the meanwhile on this side of the Atlantic. His latest, Spies of the Balkans, follows on the heels of his 2008, Spies of Warsaw. It takes place in the ancient port of Salonika, a rough-and-tumble town of wharves and warehouses, gangsters and spies. It's 1940. Mussolini's Italy threatens from the north, and behind Italy, the menacing shadow of Hitler's war machine. First's new hero, senior police official Costazanis, is drawn into the effort to save his homeland and Europe's Jews from the evil that's hunting them. I sat down with Alan First in his tiny writing studio in Sag Harbor, New York. He's a disciplined writer, putting in 4 hours every morning, during which time he's sustained just by coffee and the occasional cigarette. It's a pace that's produced some 15 books, the earliest 4 of which were never published.
I started writing too young. I was 29 and wrote 4 not very good novels, which didn't sell. And then I redid everything and started all over again, basically, now knowing what I wanted to write. But it took me a long time to figure that out. And in the interim, since I was a writer, I kept writing these novels, and they were all published and well published. I mean, Athenaeum, Doubleday, Delacorte, like that.
What did you change?
What happened to me was this. I had wanted to write, but I didn't have anything to say. Particularly, like a lot of people. So I attempted to write entertaining murder mysteries, sex and drugs and rock and roll, which unfortunately people don't actually want to read about. They want to do it, but they don't want to read about it particularly. So until I hit upon the idea of writing historic spy novels, writing about Eastern Europe, writing about communism versus fascism, none of that was in the early books. They were just really exercises in what? In egotism? I don't know what you call it. They were exercises in talent. They were exercises in being smartass. Call it whatever you want, but they were wrong in that way. And for whatever reason, publishers liked them because they were well written, because I could always do that. But they had no heart, and they had no scope, and they had no moral power. And Matthew Arnold said this in the 19th century, but he wasn't wrong. If you don't have moral purpose, you can't write a novel.
Why is that?
I don't know. It has to do with the dynamic of it. But it's been said many times, people are reluctant to say it because it sounds Victorian, it sounds religious, it sounds extreme, it sounds preachy. But I don't mean any of that. I had a friend in Seattle who was a very smart guy, owned a bookstore. And after I'd finish a book, a few months would go by, and he'd say, well, are you mad enough to start another book? I had never said anything to him about that, but it was his instinct that you had to be angry in order to write a novel. Now, there are plenty of novelists who would tell you that that's not true at all. But he was wiggling around toward what I just said, that you have to have some intense feeling about right and wrong in order to write 350 pages of manuscript and do it right.
And how did that bring you into writing historical thrillers?
Well, I changed from murder mysteries, which are local in nature. The murder is in the garden, or it's in the drawing room, or it's the postman, or it's something like that. I wanted to write about Europe. I knew that. I had no desire to write about the United States. I wanted to write about sophisticated people. I wanted to write about educated people. I wanted to write about even royalty or high life in that way. And I wanted to write about people who had some sense of what might go on in the future. Now, given all of that, where you come out is a spy novel or an espionage novel or what I now – I used to call them spy novels. People bugged me about it. So I started calling them novels about spies, and that made people happier.
And that does bring us to Spies of the Balkans. This novel takes place like – almost all of your novels, although a lot of them also have some action in Paris, and even this one does as well, but almost all of them do take place in Eastern Europe. This one starts in 1940, and we're in Greece this time. Tell us a little bit about what's going on at that time.
All of my novels are very time-sensitive because I'm very careful to stay on the dates of the history. So once you start writing about Greece, what happened to Greece? Greece was invaded by Germany. So where you have to start this book, you don't really have a choice, is basically October of 1940, when Greece was invaded by Italy, and Greece fought back and kicked their butts. The Italian soldiers didn't want to fight. Why are we fighting Greece? What's that about? You know, so Greece pushed them all the way back up into the middle of Albania, which they had occupied. The problem was, and the essence of this novel, was that the more the Greeks won in Albania, beat the Italians, the more they knew that Hitler could not afford to have the Axis sustain a defeat, and they knew they would be invaded by Germany. They knew it.
And you cited this not in Athens, but in Salonika.
In Balkan Greece, yeah. I didn't want to write a novel about Greece from the perspective of Athens or from beautiful little islands with fishing boats. That's not the Greece I was interested in. I was interested in a darker, more muscular Greece. Salonika is essentially the Chicago of Greece. As New York is to Athens, Chicago is to Salonika. It's very rough, extremely rough and tumble city, Balkan city, at one time a Jewish city, known as the Jerusalem of the Balkans, and Jews were, I believe, a majority in Salonika for a considerable number of long time.
And they had come from the diaspora from Spain, isn't that right?
Yeah, in 1492. And I saw something somewhere that explained how they came to be there, where someone had said that when people are expelled from someplace, or that when the Jews were expelled from the various places, they kept moving south in hopes that the sun and the warmth would find them happier, nicer people. I don't know if it's true, but I did read that, and then I had to think about that for a while.
And of course, for those who know some of the history of World War II in Greece, in Salonika, Salonika is it's like a bell tolling.
It is. The Jews who didn't get out, couldn't get out, were murdered. I mean, they were taken away to the camps, and that was the end of it. And that was the end of the Jewish community in Salonika.
Okay, so you have a new hero in this story. Some of your stories you have...
Only once. There's only one repetition of a hero, and I didn't want to do that. It was my publisher that insisted on that. No, there's a new... You get a nice, new, fresh hero in every book for you to unwrap and set up and consider and read the diagram and see how it's a male, works. So, yeah, I know. I always do that. I always change heroes in every book. What stays the same, there are some minor characters who reappear.
And his name is Costa Zanis, and tell us about him.
He is a policeman who didn't really particularly want to be a policeman. He needed desperately to have a job. He found that. He did well at it because he's a tolerant sort of person. Gets people to do, as it says in the book, it gets people to do what he wants without hitting them. And for a policeman in Salonika in 1940, that was very progressive. And this particular policeman becomes, in the course of the book, or is at the start of the book, what it's called a senior police official. You don't hear this phrase anymore, but oh boy, do you ever see it when you read about the 30s and 40s in Europe. And I had read it so many times, in so many contexts, and there's something very opaque and suggestive about it.
And what did you find out that it was all about?
Well, what I decided what it was about was that this person was, in part, the political arm of the Salonika police. He was there to handle cases that were too hot and too difficult, celebrities, Greek ship owners, politicians, consuls being blackmailed, whatever it was. Every police department, I suspect, has someone or other that they can trust to be discreet and to handle things quietly and not to be a bull in a china shop about it.
And he has a kind of mentor, which is a character that you've had in other novels as well. The hero has a kind of older aristocratic gentleman, and in this case it's Vangelis.
Vangelis, I say. I like to say it that way. That may be wrong. I don't know. My Greek is non-existent. But Vangelis is the commissioner of the Salonika police force. He's 80 or more and venerated and known as Saint Vangelis, which is the way it's put in the book is that was a title for people who could abide veneration and irony in the same phrase. He is no saint. But yet, on the other hand, he kind of is, you know, and he's a good man.
Right, exactly. And he plays a small but key role in the book.
Very important role in the book. He's always there. He's a presence. He's a guide. He's the one who, when Costa Zanis begins to operate in a clandestine fashion, and it starts with saving Jews who get to Salonika from Germany, he's the one who says, you need a bank account that doesn't come from the municipality of Salonika. And he shows him how to set it up, and he tells him how to get the money, which is you go to one of the richest people in Salonika and say, I need money to do secret things. And in that conversation with this particular not very nice character, he lets slip, or actually the other person says, I'm told that you'll be commissioner someday. And Zanis goes, oh, well, that's in the future. But if you read, oh, that's in the future another way, it means yes, and you'd better do what I want you to do now. You don't need the money, and I do.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Alan First, master of the historical spy thriller, about writing suspense fiction, and about his latest novel, Spies of the Balkans. I'm just curious about this mentor, because he does crop up so many times in your books. Is there some reason for that?
Well, it's maybe only this reason, that people have them. It's part of life. If you think about it, there's generally someone in your life who's important, who typically is older, not necessarily, but typically is, more experienced than you, with entree to whatever it is you then want to do. I mean, a lot of my people, when they become involved in the clandestine life that was a great, powerful thing in Europe in the 1930s and 40s, when they realized that their only way to strike back at an enemy was in that way, they didn't. These are not experienced people in that field. So there's always got to be someone who tells them what to do, who knows the ropes, who is the consummate spy in some novels, in this case the consummate policeman. But there's always somebody being consummate there somewhere.
And did you have a mentor also?
Well, I've always had mentors, I suppose. But I knew an older writer when I first started writing long, long ago, and he did say things to me that were by way of telling me how this business worked. Most important, how the profession worked. I was unsuccessful at the time, and he was very encouraging. He was a guy named Jack Olson, who had been with Sports Illustrated, Time Inc. You know, he was a real old-fashioned, hard-nosed writer, and he told me a lot of stuff. But was he a mentor? No, not exactly. He really wasn't. He was like a fan, is what he was like.
And now back to the book. Zenas sets up this network, as you say, an escape network for Jews, and then the plot thickens. It begins to draw in. It draws the interest of spies, British spies, not the most savory characters in some ways.
No, not savory at all. But people, you know, who are by necessity terrific opportunists, and they see what he's got that he put together, and they go, well, then we'll have that too, thank you. You know, when you discover something like that and you're in the business of needing people to operate secretly and quietly and effectively and courageously, and you find someone else who has those toys, what's going to happen?
So this is kind of, as you say, there's a moral force in this book, as in all your books, and it really is centered around the character himself. I mean, he is, the British come to him, they ask him for a favor, he's not too pleased about it, but he does it because, well, there's a war on and there's this need.
Yeah, no, to say no is impossible. Even if you don't want to say yes, there's times when to say no is impossible.
So what are some of the thinking that you've done in developing the story and in the other stories that you've done of the moral ambiguities of war, of having to do things that maybe aren't quite right because they have to be done?
There were no moral ambiguities in this war of any kind. And that's why I write about the period. If you tried to write a book like this about succeeding wars, wars of the future, there is a huge moral ambiguity. In some instances, Vietnam, for example, such moral ambiguity that the population didn't feel like it wanted to sacrifice the life that it takes to have a war. So I write about a period when there's definite right and wrong. No question about that. There's no question about who needed to win this war. And if people know it now, they also knew it back then.
Yeah, and I didn't mean the moral ambiguity of the war, because that's precisely what in some ways allows people to do things that aren't so nice, maybe so moral in another sense, things that they have to do against their will because of this higher purpose. And I just wonder if that's is a conflict that helps to inform the fiction.
Of course, and I assume it does in life too, although life turns out to be maybe somewhat simpler than that, or at least it was in the 40s. After the war, someone did a survey among the French people who had worked on the escape lines that brought pilots out of occupied France, or even as far as Germany or wherever they came from. Now, a pilot is a weapon. You know, a trained pilot, it's like one of those miracle machines that contemporary movies talk about, you know, except those things are all full of white glossy enamel and engines and lasers. But forget it. A pilot in 1940 was an important thing. Anyhow, they asked these French people, a lot of them, scores of them, why did you get involved in this? At potential great danger to yourself and your family, and the answer was always the same, because I was asked.
What does that say to you?
I'm not entirely sure. I think what it says to me is that in a state of war, in a state where you are resisting real serious evil, and you can see it, and it's all around you, people are more than willing to do incredibly dangerous things. But they need to know how to do it. You can't just get up in the morning and say, I'm going to strike a blow against the Nazis. What are you going to do? Hit somebody with a stick? I mean, it's not clear to people. I think they sense that there are organizations operating underground, but they can't find them. They better not be able to find them. Anyhow, that's the way it worked, and I'm not surprised at that answer, although when I first heard it, not the answer I expected to hear.
My father was in the Dutch resistance during the war, and it actually became in some ways the touchstone of his life. After the war, I don't think he ever really got used to ordinary living. You know, he wasn't a particularly heroic person before. He was a bicycle boy. You know, he was a young, jejune guy who loved American jazz and liked to dance, and he was married, and he didn't know much about anything. And then he was asked by his downstairs neighbors to take in a young man, an adolescent, into his home. And he had a sister who was married to a Jew, and between those two things, he got quite involved in the underground. But it really changed. To him, it made him become the person he said. He said he was a pea in the pod, and he never would have sprouted without that.
Well, exactly. That's what happens to people. And then, of course, they become almost instantly addicted to the adrenaline, to danger, because he survived it. Yeah, yeah. I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. I've heard those stories before.
And we're speaking with Alan First about his latest spy thriller of World War II. It's Spies of the Balkans, and I've enjoyed every single one of the books of yours that I've read. I have to say, I am a fan.
Oh, thank you.
I just loved this the most. How do you feel about it? I mean, when you look at your books, do you have your favorites?
Well, they're all my favorites. That's not true. There are certain of them that stick above the line. And the interesting part of that is there are different reasons each time for that. This time out, what happened was I really had to consider family and context more than I ever did before. And I think that's why people really like this book. And my other books were maybe cooler or chillier, where people didn't have that much to lose. Because it's typical of heroes or heroines in these kinds of books that they don't really have the baggage of ordinary human life. That's removed. James Bond was not concerned with his sister-in-law. However, I couldn't do that this time, and that added a dimension that made this a very, very successful book. It sold a lot of copies.
Was this like a conscious decision, or this character, just his family was part of him?
It was both. I had really determined that I needed to do this, that my characters lived two cold lives, that they needed to be realer, and they needed, for this book especially, to be closer to the reader's life. You know, readers have husbands, wives, children, parents, dogs, cats, canaries, what? And so did the people in Salonika. And a lot of the problem with leaving Salonika was that there were people who had relatives they couldn't leave. And then they all died. So it's a real issue in war, and it always has been, especially in terms of this book, where people have the time, at least, to escape.
Because they knew it was coming.
Months. It's months. It went from November to the following April.
Yeah. They had months, and yet when you make the decision to actually leave your home, that can take a lot longer than even months.
It depends how motivated you are. It can take no minutes at all. Somebody was telling me a story at some party I was at on Saturday night, talking about someone they knew who was related to, who had been in Germany in 1933. And they said to me, well, when Hitler won that election, when he was made the chancellor, or whatever it was that he was made first, that person, and this individual paused, and I said, left Germany. And the woman I was talking to said, never return to his house. He knew he was on a list.
And so does, well, I don't know if she knows that she's on a list, but one of the characters in this book, Spies of the Balkans, is definitely on a list.
Absolutely. And she should assume she's on a list simply because of her profile within the society she belongs to, which is to say she's part of the upper class of German Berlin, so you can well believe the Gestapo would know exactly who she is.
And married to a German officer.
Married to a German officer, and very much in love, and this was never a problem in the 20s when they were married. She's a banker's daughter, and she falls in love with a German officer. He's a logistics officer for the general staff. He's not a Nazi or anything like that. But when Hitler comes in, his first instinct is to leave in protest, to resign his commission. Then he realizes that unless he keeps it, he leaves his wife, who is Jewish, vulnerable. So of necessity, he stays.
And of course, there was quite a conspiracy within the German command against Hitler. I mean, there were people who did stay, although many of them, it took them a while to figure out what Hitler was really about.
Yes and no. There were a lot of conspiracies. They started early with that bomb that was in the wine cellar in Munich or the beer hall or wherever it was. There was another one when he went to the Eastern Front. There's another one they were going to bring his plane down. He didn't take the plane. On and on and on. They all came out of either the German army, which felt that it would be destroyed by being forced into the war that Hitler wanted to fight, and from the upper class of German society, which realized what was going to happen. There's no way to win it, especially after he invaded Russia. Oh, they knew what happened to Napoleon.
And then finally, I just want to ask you, who are your literary mentors, not in the sense of an actual person, a personal relationship, but in terms of the writers who have informed or influenced your work?
Well, there's two sets. One set are people who are adventure novelists who are never called adventure novelists. So you start with Stendhal and you go right to Conrad and you go to Malraux and you go to Isaac Babel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is a great crowd. That's one group. And in terms of prose, purely that, I'm very dependent on the British writers of the 30s and 40s. And you know who you're talking about. You're talking about Anthony Powell properly, or Powell, since it's going over the air. And you're talking about Waugh, and you're talking about George Orwell, and you're talking about Christopher Isherwood, you're talking about Auden, you're talking about phenomenal, great writers, no question.
And Graham Greene.
I left him out. I didn't mean to. He's not my favorite, but he's very good.
Well, Alan Furst, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your latest book is Spies of the Balkans.
Thanks for having me.
Read an excerpt from Spies of the Balkans at writersvoice.net. Alan Furst has written numerous spy thrillers, among them Night Soldiers, The World at Night, Dark Voyage, and The Foreign Correspondent. Our 2006 interview with him about The Foreign Correspondent is coming up next. Stick around.
In Germany, before the war, there was a man who owned a store. In 1934, in Dusseldorf. And every night at 5:09, he'd cross the park down to the Rhine. And he'd sit there by the shore. I'm looking at the river, but I'm thinking of the sea. Thinking of the sea. I'm looking at the river, but I'm thinking of the sea. A little girl has lost her way.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I first interviewed Alan First in 2006. He'd just written The Foreign Correspondent, which takes place mainly in Paris, his second favorite setting for his historical spy thrillers. This time, his hero is a journalist, Carlo Weiss, an expatriate Italian fighting the Mussolini regime by writing for the opposition newspaper, The Liberazione. The year is 1938. The storm clouds of war are gathering on the horizon, and Weiss is struggling to keep both his paper and himself alive. The book is a compelling portrait of Europe as it struggles with the opposing forces of fascism and freedom, forces that find their echoes today as the world grapples with terror and war. Alan First got interested in writing about World War II when he went to the Soviet Union in 1983 for Esquire magazine.
And for the first time in my life, I saw a police state. This really had an incredible effect on me. I mean, I knew it existed. It wasn't a surprise rationally in any way. But emotionally and psychologically, I never understood what it was and how it worked. And once I saw that, I changed completely. I had now kind of a political point of view and a powerful one. And once I realized that that's all I really ever wanted to write about, it became very apparent to me that if you wrote about the 1930s, which is the kind of the central turning point of the 20th century, you would be writing about the time of the most idealistic sorts of struggles between communism and fascism and parliamentary democracy in Britain and Republican France, etc., and so forth. It was the high drama decade, shall we say, Hitler coming to power in 33, running to the first years of World War II, about 1942, winter of 42-43.
Well, now The Foreign Correspondent is a story of an Italian emigre, a journalist in Paris, who's fled Mussolini's Germany. Talk more about the historical setting of the novel in terms of where he was coming from.
Well, he is typical of a certain class of Italian which follows the actual history. First of all, to my surprise when I started researching this novel, Mussolini came to power in Italy in 1922, 11 years before Hitler, and was a model for Hitler. And as fascism grew in Italy, people began to have to get out of the country, and a number of them went to Paris. And these were people, you're talking about journalists, you're talking about college professors, you're talking about lawyers, doctors, businessmen, upper middle class people. And once they were in Paris, they found themselves trying to survive as taxi drivers, working in department stores, working as meter readers for the gas company. And to continue the struggle against Mussolini, who had, and fascism, which had effectively destroyed their lives, their families, their livelihood, their professional careers, everything. They resorted to, the easiest way to say it is, underground newspapers. Because in fact, that's what they were, the clandestine press. And these people basically wrote these newspapers in Paris, as they do in this book. The manuscript was then smuggled into Italy, where it was printed and secretly distributed. And this all happened, this is all true. The four groups that did this broke down into the usual politics of the period. The resistance was communist, socialist, liberal, and Catholic. And there were 512 such newspapers, as near as the Italian historians can count. By 1943, when the real fighting, partisan fighting, broke out in Italy between Italian partisans in the hills and the German, the SS particularly, and the German army.
And I think of the paper Klaus Mann in Paris put out with André Gide. So did you base this on specific paper that you knew of during that time?
No, I based it on what I knew of all of them that were put out at the time. And it became apparent to me as I thought about it that this is a side of resistance that's not used in novels very much, but I happened to notice watching the History Channel one night, they had a story on about the American Revolution, And I realized that the images they showed, along with that story, they showed as many printing presses as they did muskets.
Hmm.
So it's actually a pretty crucial part of the whole process. And as you begin to think about it that way, you realize, like, a certain television stations in the particular kinds of things that are going on right now matter a great deal. So there's always an information war that precedes or accompanies an armed war.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Alan First about his thriller, The Foreign Correspondent. And your protagonist is part of that war. He's a journalist, Carlo Weiss. Now, he plays multiple roles, some that perhaps in the current concept of journalism could be seen as contradictory. He's a journalist, but he's also a partisan, and he's the editor of Liberazione, which is this newspaper you speak about. And he also ends up being a spy for the Brits. Oh, can I say that?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about these roles of the journalist as partisan as opposed to the journalist as objective, as apart from things?
Well, the way I would see it is a journalist steps into a professional career with the idea that he or she is going to be nonpartisan. But let's face it, if you take that same individual and set him or her down in combat zones, where people are fighting, where people are dying, where there's a war going on, very quickly they're going to simply, their humanity will assert itself, and they will realize that they are a partisan to one side or the other. I can't think of a situation in which that isn't true. And that, of course, Carlo Weiss is very partisan. He knows he has to, when he's writing for Reuters as a foreign correspondent, he has to at least seem to be nonpartisan, but he isn't. He is against the fascists, he's against Hitler, he's against Mussolini, and no one really minds that because, in general, England felt that way, or Great Britain felt that way. And then, as well, he is also asked to be the editor of the Liberazione underground paper after the former editor is murdered by Italian secret police, along with his mistress in a Paris hotel. He's happy to have that second job, although it's dangerous. And it's equally true that as an émigré in Paris, and part of an important émigré organization, he comes under pressure from various secret services who would tend to use émigré groups for their own purposes, and I don't think this is very new in this world. And this book is about the attempt of these people. I mean, these people in their 40s and 50s, who all wear eyeglasses, to try to deal with secret police, with secret services, with this, that, and the other. They have no ability or training to do that. And they have meetings, and you see some of the meetings in the book, and they say, what are we supposed to do about this? I mean, really, what are we supposed to do about it? In much the same way that any group of, say, 10 or 12 listeners to this program would get together and say, well, now this awful thing has happened and we're under all this pressure. Should we just give in? Should we fight back? If we're going to fight back, how exactly do you do that?
Well, he's actually employed by the Brits to write a kind of propaganda memoir about a character named Colonel Ferrara.
Well, it's Ferrara who actually writes the memoir. Ferrara, I should say, just explain a little bit who he is. He's an Italian colonel in the army who, in protest against Mussolini's policies after the dreadful attacks in Abyssinia, which is, I guess, now Ethiopia, leaves the army, defects essentially, and goes and hides out in the south of France. There he talks to reporters. Thereby he is defamed by the Italian fascist newspapers. He goes to fight in Spain, as many of these people did. It was commonplace. In Spain, he is something of a hero, fights against Italian fascists, who Mussolini sent to fight in Spain, and eventually has to flee. The British become interested in him as potentially the author of basically a propaganda book. But, you know, where that comes from is I certainly didn't make that up. You when you read in the period, you see these.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't say that, this is a work that was sponsored by the Soviet secret services. You don't know that. But I have to say, some of the books you see, you wonder how on earth this person ever came to write such a book, and how on earth it got published, and how on earth it got as widely distributed as it did. And so you have to say, well, possibly someone was helping it out.
Yeah, except that the stories are real. At least Colonel Ferrara's story is real, and I guess the cause is a good one.
The cause is a good one. The story is real. We're glad he wrote the book. You know, I mean, it just depends what side you're on. You can spend time arguing against the technique, if you like, but it's as old as the world. In other words, propaganda is as old as the world. And I would say that most people perceive it as legitimate. Yeah. I don't believe that everybody tells the truth. You know, and what is the truth, P.S.? I think what you get instead is politics, where people give a version of the truth which proves the particular point they want to prove.
Right. Well, you talked about the folks who are in the newspaper and that they have to deal with being targeted by basically the Secret Service, Mussolini's Secret Service.
Right.
The OVRA.
OVRA, yes.
The OVRA. Most people have heard of the Gestapo. Talk about the OVRA and their operations outside of Italy.
Not everything is known about what they did, but essentially it was a political action police force that had secret bases in various places in Europe where it was felt by the people who ran the government in Italy that their political agenda needed to be reinforced by violence or by secret operations of some kind or another. And you see various names given for this as though it was an acronym, OVRA, which turned out to mean something like Organization for the Repression of Anti-Fascism. In fact, what I discovered doing research about it is that it's not an acronym at all. What seems to have happened is that Mussolini was dictating a memo, and in it he said that he wanted a secret police that would act like a piovra in Italian, which is a kind of an octopus. The idea being it would have tentacles that reached everywhere. And there was a misprint when the typed version of the dictation came back to him, in which the organization was called OVRA. And he liked that, the sound of that word. He thought it was intimidating and frightening. And so he determined that that should be the name of the political police. And so it was.
Well, that must have been pretty exciting to discover the truth about a historical detail.
Well, I only discovered it from a historian writing about it, you know, and it wasn't. I don't do any primary research.
So, talk about the research in doing this book. You're not doing primary research, but what were some of the richest sources that you went to?
It's very hard for me to do that. There are so many different sources that I used because there are so many, how to say, lead topics in this book. I had to do some research on foreign correspondents in the period, how they operated, what became of them, what happened to them, who they were. I read many of their books, and that's one topic. But I also had to do research on both the history of Italy during this period and the secret history of Italy during this period, or the history of Italian secrecy during this period. And that's two different topics. One is intelligence history, and the other is national history. Really, they ought to be taught together, but it's treated as two different things. You have to know both if you're going to write about a country.
Unlike historians, novelists have to get all the little details right that give their work verisimilitude. I asked Alan First where he gets those little details.
It's not where I get them. I get them everywhere. It's more than once happened to me that I've read an entire book, and in that book there is a description of one small moment and one small thing, and I use that. And it could be a novel or it could be a nonfiction book of the period. But I think the trick is, if you're me and you're writing the kind of fiction that I write, is knowing where the really great details are. You know, what is a good detail? What is a telling detail? And I'll give you an instance of that. In The Foreign Correspondent, there is a clandestine meeting in a park outside Berlin. And it's not necessary to the plot. It's just part of the scenery of that day. But operating in that park is a carnival, and part of the carnival is what was called, and this is a real thing, the Lant Stunter, L-A-N-D-T. And what that was a ride for children where children could sit in make-believe dive bombers on a long pole, and they could pretend to dive bomb, you know, the populace or whatever, or a train or anything else. And it had little machine guns that sparkled in the wings. It's like a carnival ride now, except that it was a war ride, and except that we're talking about Germany in 1939, and we're talking about at least some of the little kids, you know, 6, 7 years old, who were wearing Nazi uniforms or the uniforms of the Hitler Youth. The rest of them are waiting on lines, as I said, some of them holding their mother's hands. You know, so it's a great detail about how Germany was at that moment and how militaristic it was at that moment.
Yeah, that was wonderful. Also, Hitler's parrot joke?
Mm-hmm. I don't remember where I found that. I think it was in a foreign correspondent book about Germany at the time. But you know, as the guy says who retells the joke in the foreign correspondent, it's Hitler's parrot joke number 39. I mean, that's just a number out of the air.
I also love Momo Zippler and his Wienerwald companions.
Well, they also appear in many of the books. As you may know, these books have heroes that change. There's a different consciousness that leads every book. But Momo Zippler and his Wienerwald companions, that is the sort of the eternal nightclub band of Central Europe, and obviously they're traveling because they appear in several of the books.
You're listening to an interview with Alan First about The Foreign Correspondent. You've also got Count Polanyi this time. He's Blood of Victory, I believe. Is that right?
That's what you're right. He's from Blood of Victory, and he also appears. Well, he is an important character. He's an important character in Kingdom of Shadows, and he also appears in Blood of Victory, and he appears briefly in this book. He is the classic Hungarian spymaster.
Right, and any particular reason he shows up so often?
Well, let's say he's a figure in the kind of the nighttime world of clandestine Europe in the 1930s, and so we encounter him more than once.
Do you ever feel that you yourself are immersed in the emotion of the period? That is, I mean, your details are so telling. You're writing about them. What about your own emotional connection to that period?
Well, it is as it was at the very beginning. It's never changed. It's the feeling of incredible empathy for people who, against all odds, tried to fight back against authority and totalitarianism. And a lot of them were not successful. I mean, a lot of them were killed,
right.
But they did it anyhow, and they were very brave people.
Yeah.
The odds were very much against them. The odds are very much against the people in this book, and some of them, many of them, survive. But it's questionable how long, you know, they'll survive. And that's my emotional tie. Obviously, my emotional tie is to the people who wanted to rid themselves of tyrants.
Right. Now, you have a love interest in this story. It's a bit more romance than usual, although there's always some. This one is more of a love story. Could you talk about that?
Well, again, you know, any novelist will tell you that when you originate characters, they don't necessarily do what you want them to do. They have an odd life of their own, really. And in this case, I started writing about this woman named Krista von Schirren, who is of Hungarian and German ancestry. And she was briefly represents one of the people in Germany who were part of a German resistance. It was not fated to last long because Germany was basically had reconstituted itself as a counterintelligence state. But they did what they could. They felt they had to do something. They were very idealistic people. Once again, I don't know that they really entirely knew what they were doing, but they tried. And they're remembered because they tried, even though they almost, I won't give it away, I'll just say that they were working against great odds, and in the course of the book, those odds increase. And the hero, she's an old, former girlfriend, of Carlo Weiss, and he sees her again when he goes back to Berlin, even though she's married, sort of a marriage of convenience in the interim, and their love affair starts up again.
Right. It seemed to me that emotional connection had something to do perhaps with the idealism also of the character. I mean, you have journalists, you have other characters in your other books that become motivated by their decency or their integrity, but this guy is an idealist to begin with, and it seems somehow more fitting that he really falls in love with her.
He really falls in love with her, completely and utterly. And I do think when you read about that period, because the fact was, in that period, many of the people didn't really expect to live a long time. So that when there were emotional attachments, they were extremely deep and passionate attachments, because it was acknowledged that maybe they wouldn't be there for each other for very long.
Yeah.
And that was true all across the board. Listen to the music of the period. It's there, in the swing music and in all kinds of ways. And it's in the movies of the period also.
Hmm. You've been writing about this period leading up to fascism, really as fascism was tightening its grip on Europe, for a long time. Now, do you have any sense now that it might be getting more pertinent to our times?
Well, I hate to say it, but in fact, there were moments when I was writing this book that were very resonant with what's going on today. Every time you pick up a newspaper, it's one more thing. The other day, I was reading the Times with my coffee in the morning, and lo and behold, they decided to suspend the rule that demands that the police identify themselves and knock on a door before they kick your door in. Well, that's apparently gone. The Supreme Court decided that that's no longer necessary, and that dates back to the 17th century, And I thought, oh, well, there goes another little piece of, the American protective freedoms that are very, very dear to us. And I think they're dear to everybody, and yet some people feel like, well, maybe we should suspend these kinds of rules because we're at war, 9/11, terrorism, et cetera, and so forth. This has happened before. It happened during the Civil War. It happened during World War I. Every time a country goes to war, its civil rights are under dire threat. And there are arguments to be made on both sides. I don't think the arguments made on what I will call the government side in this instance are very good. I don't think they're good arguments at all. I think it's opportunism where people seize the moment after 9/11 to institute certain kinds of operations that are not maybe in the best interests of American freedoms.
Yeah. Now, talking about 9/11, I'm going to ask you a question that was actually on the list of suggested questions, which I usually ignore, but this one really piqued my interest because what it says here, and I'll read it.
I should say this comes out of Random House. It isn't necessarily one that I've thought up.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't assume that authors do think these up. I think publicists think them up, but some of them are good. And this one really piqued my interest because it says, some well-known authors, including John Updike and Nelson DeMille, are coming out with novels using today's terrorism as a backdrop. Are you tempted to write a modern novel set against the war on terror?
No. I will probably not write a contemporary novel. It simply wouldn't come out very good. It would come out to be, I believe, mean-spirited and not very attractive.
Why?
I just know that that's what would happen. It's just the times that we're living in are, to me, not the best of times in a variety of ways. It's the times we live in, though. You don't get to pick. Mm-hmm. You just have to live with what goes on. We're a nation at this moment that's about half and half between and engaged in culture wars, and I don't want to write about stuff like that.
Yeah.
I just don't. It's not that I don't care. I do care. I care as a civilian, that when I'm not writing, I care a lot. But when I'm writing, I prefer to stay in a period when it wasn't a culture war. It was a real war.
And there's a lot of inspiration in it, too. So, well, the novel is The Foreign Correspondent by Alan First. This has been lovely to speak with you.
Thank you so much. It was a really good interview. I liked doing it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This program consists of music composed by Allied prisoners of war and civilian internees in German prison camps. And it is coming to you from the studios of the Swedish Broadcasting Company in Stockholm. Representatives of the Swedish YMCA have for some time been visiting the prisoners of war camps in various countries and doing what they can to make life easier for the internees. As many prisoners try to overcome the depressing circumstances in which they now must live by composing music, the Swedish Broadcasting Company suggested to the YMCA officials that they should collect a number of such compositions which could then be broadcast. It is from this material that the melodies you are now going to hear have been selected. The title of the first song is Numbers. The music has been written by a British prisoner, William Hildesheimer, and the words are by D. Parsons and R. D. S. Gibson.
Far from father, far from mother, far from sister, far from brother, far from all that's dear. Not for thieving nor deceiving, not for cheating nor wife beating, are we locked in here. Numbers, that's what we are now. Numbers, added anyhow, we make a song. That's my drum, and quite full of awful numbers. Yea, in spite of them, numbers, we make light of them. Wait for the day when we without numbers.
That was a recording from the book Music Behind Barbed Wire, A Diary of Internment by Billy Hildesheimer. Hildesheimer was interned by the Germans in POW camps from 1941 to 1945. Actually, he was very lucky. He was a Jew, but because he had a British passport, he was able to pass as a British prisoner of war. He survived, and I met him when he was in his 90s and had the great fortune of being treated to an impromptu private concert by him. He died last year at the age of 95. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.